My name is Erin O'Brien, and I'm the membership editor at War on the Rocks. This is The Insider, the members-only podcast where we ask War on the Rocks authors to reflect on their articles and why they matter for national security. Today, I am joined by Ryan Pallas, author of How to Boil a Frog, The Dangers of Downsizing in the U.S. Military, which was published on August 26. Ryan is an active duty Marine Corps officer who has completed tours at Miramar, California, Yuma, Arizona, Kanaohe Bay, Hawaii, and Quantico, Virginia. He currently serves as a commandant of the Marine Corps Strategist Fellow in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia, where he is studying the all-volunteer force. The views expressed here are those of the author and do not reflect those of the Marine Corps, the Department of Defense, or any other government agency. And now that I've gotten all that out of the way, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Erin. Pleasure to be here.
So, as always, I was wondering if you could start off this episode of The Insider with a little overview of your main argument. I mean, what was this piece really about and what made you want to write it?
So the argument itself, I'll build you a watch, I guess, to tell you the time. So in the fall of 23, myself and Eric Reed, a Marine who's written about Marine Corps personnel policies, presented a paper at an academic conference that looked at how standards, policies, and prerequisites or quote unquote beliefs have shifted over time or increased when they're applied to personnel. And that was probably the starting point when I really began to think hard about the actual problem. It resulted in a working paper that we presented and got some really good feedback from the scholars that were at the conference. And then it kind of got shelved. And then through, I guess, practical application, this summer I've been lucky enough to conduct a lot of archival research during the volunteer era. So from 1973 till 2023 is what I'm looking at. And in that time, I didn't realize it at first, but I saw this pattern when I was going through a lot of the documents that what Eric and I had written about previously, I kind of saw happening in real time, either looking at the testimonies or statements of senior military leaders, and then kind of seeing this confluence of factors between like budget reductions, testimony, and end strength reductions, how there was this subsequent increase in what you want to call qualitative standards by senior leaders. And at first, in isolation, I was like, man, this totally makes sense, right? But then I guess looking at the over the course of time and decades, you see how problematic it becomes. And then kind of the result of where the all-volunteer force or all-recruited force is today in terms of try to really get at the question of what is the baseline for military service was really the question and the answer that Eric and I were getting at. And then that kind of morphed into the article. And it actually kind of, I guess, formulated itself pretty easily because I've been looking at it for this point, probably like 8 or 10 months. And I didn't even realize it until I stumbled upon it. And it was almost accidental, the article, kind of how it came to fruition. But it actually happened pretty quickly once I kind of put all the pieces together due to the fact that I've been kind of living in the archives. And I don't want to say the article wrote itself, but literally looking back over this expansive time period, you see this, and it's depicted in the article of this, I guess, raising of the floor in terms of for the baseline for military requirements. And I guess why that's important, I guess, to anybody listening is, you know, from a very practical perspective, all militaries require people. Even the shifts toward unmanned systems and technology and robotics are going to require people. One could argue probably the article kind of hints at that, but moving forward, you're going to look for a specific kind of person that can leverage these technologies. But also, there's a whole bunch of jobs that the military, all militaries have to offer. So you need this like wide range of people. But you need people, right? And so when it's hard to just attract just the numbers that are required, and that's kind of what the article wanted to boil down, to provide senior leaders, whether that's civilian or military, a very mathematical approach to a problem set to say, hey, like just from basic math, the standards over time, if we're going to use some assumptions in the survey data and everything else that we have, along with the demographic data that's available, this is almost mathematically impossible for us to expect recruiters to achieve without an over-reliance. And this is kind of what it gets to, without an over-reliance on waivers. And so really to start questioning that process, provide senior leaders maybe just a very basic mathematical representation of a problem set, and a problem set that can sometimes get muddled or very emotionally charged, which personnel issues sometimes do. But just to provide data to be like, hey, like, mathematically, this is a problem.
And I want to get a little bit more in to the why these requirements have been put in place in a second. But first, I want to ask about the archives, which we love to ask about on this podcast. I mean, what exactly were you seeing in terms of requirements being introduced? What did you see in the documents? And like, at what junctures were these kind of things introduced? Where did they start to change?
That's a great question. That's still one I'm trying to put together, because it's over the course of 5 decades, from 73 to 2023. When you kind of step back, it becomes clear. But the end of World War II, you see personnel end strength for the military being extremely high. I don't want to say this is accurate, but it was like close to 12 million, I believe. And then you see present day, overall, you see a declination of end strength. In the volunteer era, there's been 2 kind of at least major reversals in end strengths, but nothing to the level of where it was before for World War II. And you see that in the early 80s. And then you see that again during OIF and OEF post September 11th, like around the mid 2000s, like 2005, 2006. So overall declining end strength, you also see an overall declination of defense budgets, specifically in percentages of GDP. But you also see, and this is probably maybe a decade or 2 decades after Vietnam, an increase in military requirements short of what you consider probably major conflict. So what you see is there's a increase in use, but a decrease in creation of resources. So this ends means disconnect in terms of people and kind of what they're used against. And so you see that really start to manifest, I would say, in the 1990s. So things like the QDR, which, I mean, I was familiar with, but not to the level I am now, you really see some trends from the late 80s, early 90s that focus on a decrease in end strength, an increase in technology to offset that, but to still provide a qualitative advantage in terms of applying technologically advanced strategies. And then you have this increased use in military forces, whether that's humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, even domestic issues. If there's some like kind of problem within, you know, hurricane or something like that, even domestically, you see a lot of this use increase over time. What that does is you start talking about readiness for the military with declining end strength. It's very hard to maintain that military readiness or military capability with declining end strength and increasing requirements. As an athlete, I always think about like, how does an athlete do this? If a runner was to go out every day and, you know, run for a PR, maybe they run the mile and they try to do it and they're redlining every day. It's almost like the military has kind of crept up on that, why they've decreased people. And I don't want to say that's unrelated to personnel, because the argument that I present is about personnel. But when you start talking about recruiting and retention, specifically retention, an overuse of people results in a degradation of retention, which therefore exacerbates the recruiting problem. So overall, I saw this picture of like, yes, it's all related. Yes, it's all this big system. But over the course of decades, you see these key events to include, you know, specifically post September 11th throughout the volunteer era of personnel. And you kind of see it over time, not necessarily in the background, but over time, specifically through the testimony of senior leaders, you see like an emphasis on quality, which, and I wrote in the article, it totally makes sense, right? Like, hey, given this budget and this decreasing end strength, we're going to provide you this quality force. That's what everybody wants to hear. And that's what I would do too. But when you step back and you look at it in the aggregate and you're like, holy cow, like over time though, it's almost like it's putting military service out of reach, probably to some pretty capable people. And that's just the question of where we are now. Can we question some of the qualitative standards applied for entrance into military service and create a baseline entrance requirement for military service to allow those that want to serve, that can serve, to serve?
And I mean, presumably the military, the Department of Defense has access to these archives and this data as well. Why do you think over these decades they've continually increased quality standards or quality requirements despite what you're saying?
That's a great question. I would say I'd be guilty of it too. I think I've been given a pretty awesome opportunity to study this. You know, the Army has a program like this. The Marine Corps has one, the Commandant Strategist. So I've been given this great opportunity. And in isolation, if you look back, even over the course of your careers, I think people are naturally prone to knowing what they know within maybe their own career or their own lifetime, or maybe within the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, if we're lucky. So not a lot of people have the opportunity to to include just day-to-day operations of making the military run, to step back and look at this problem. And it's one of the reasons I chose to do it, to try to provide back to the team, the DOD, you know, the research I've been doing, to say, hey, like, I'm sure there's a ton of people that are busy with critically important problems of the day, running across the gamut of DOD requirements, real world contingencies, conflict. You know, we have two problem theaters right now. The last thing anybody has time to do is to go sit in the archives and read, you know, 50 years of like testimony and documents and budget data. I don't think it's anyone's fault. It's just the opportunity I've been given where I've had time to actually set aside to look at this. But the other thing is, I think from a naturally human perspective, as senior leaders get, you know, senior, they're responsible for more. And it becomes a time management issue in terms of, right, they have, you know, how they make decisions, how they process data, their staffs and everything else. And I mean, it's just a human thing. We all rely upon biases or heuristics to quickly navigate those situations to try to possibly formulate the best possible outcome for that decision. But over time, and that's the point of the article, I would say the same thing. I would do the same exact thing if I were in any other shoes of like, if I was, you know, a service chief for the day, I'd be like, hey, like, this is what I'm going to do. Like, you're going to give me this budget. I'm going to give you the best quality force I can for that budget. But when you step back, you're like, man, this is a problem when it's repeated. Because the other thing is too, I think what is missing, and this is where it becomes more important, is how are those requirements or standards going to be satisfied in the future? And, you know, not a lot of people think, because things do pile up, we think about like, how can we navigate today, maybe a year or two in advance, but we're not thinking like a decade, two decades in the future, how this is going to look. And then to couple that with, you know, not only looking at the DOD as an organization, which is massive, but also trying to look at how society is changing. So you're talking about two massive bodies. You have society and the DOD, and then you're trying to take the time to analyze how these are both changing over decades. I mean, I don't think anybody has the time to do that. And I've been lucky to have that opportunity. So to be able to do that and hopefully give back to say, hey, I think this is a problem, pretty unique. And I feel pretty privileged to have been given that opportunity by the Marine Corps.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I mean, going back to the argument of the article, I mean, what are the real world risks that you see or you foresee in continuing to increase these kind of quality force requirements and therefore running up against this massive recruitment problem?
Yeah. So I think number one is just having the people, like, to deny somebody that wants military service that may be qualified, if we take another look at some of the entrance requirements, I think that's a good thing. You know, the world's changed and I don't think it's anybody's fault. I think we rarely go back and revisit some of those things. So to widen the body or the pool of people that are available for military service, I think is an awesome thing when you talk about national security. Like, if you have people that want to serve, and to go into that, you're making what seems to be a smaller body of people that now serve in uniform. You may be, I don't want to say advertising, but making military service more appealing to those that may not have thought about it otherwise or had the opportunity to do that by doing this. So when you start talking about civ-mil relations a little bit, I think, you know, instead of shortening the pool, you're broadening that pool to try to encourage those that have been told in the past, hey, you can't serve, that, yeah, you can. And I think, you know, and this is one of the things that I saw, and I think it holds true. And this isn't to de-emphasize the importance of technology and the weapon systems that are used in, you know, the military. But if you look across, you know, industries, whether that's the military or, you know, the civilian or private sectors, they use the word human capital, but people are the most important resource that any organization has. And, you know, setting a bar too high, you know, the military as any business has to still appeal to those people. And I wrote that. And I think that's super important. And I think people sometimes miss that. And I understand why. But, you know, as a business organization, not only do you have to be able to attract, you have to allow the people to enter into your business to be able to work for you. And so I think from a business practice, we go back and maybe question some of those things that, you know, may have existed previously when the military could afford to do that, then sure, absolutely. But as things change and we artificially maybe create a smaller pool to which we can recruit from, I think that becomes problematic. And so just to kind of broaden that up a little bit, or maybe, you know, bring it to some senior leaders' attention to be like, hey, maybe this isn't really great for what we're doing. And this is not me saying this is the only solution or the solution, because I know there's a lot of really smart people trying to tackle this problem right now it's just a solution that when you think about it is super counterintuitive and probably an argument that not many people would make. And I totally get it. And something I mentioned in the article, it's like, yeah, like this doesn't make any sense. Like what you're saying is we're going in the opposite direction. So a counterintuitive argument isn't always one that's easily sold to senior leaders. So to be able to put that out there to be like, hey, like I think this may be able to help us a little bit is kind of, I think, the important takeaway.
And when you look at these requirements or, you know, qualifications, what are the ones that you think could be more malleable or perhaps could be reconsidered to be able to bring more people into the force?
Ooh, that is a great question. I think it all starts with physical requirements. Eric Reed, who I co-authored a paper with in the fall, he kind of had a good little speech about it. But he's like, you know, if you're something as simple as like missing a digit or, you know, maybe you have like a club foot or something, like, you know, one of those medical requirements that may not be as important as we think it is, or going through, there's like 50 greater than 50 some odd waivers that are like normally, you know, navigated, going back through then kind of starting there. Cause if everything is a waiver, is it really almost in a way, right? So again, just questioning that, but that's really what it is to not necessarily say there's a thing, but I think the physical requirements would be a good starting place. It doesn't have to be. I just think looking at the waiver process and what those waivers are for, but the article does lean heavily on the overemphasis of physical standards, which I think have, you know, increased in a way without looking at, you know, the occupational breakdown in terms of, you know, technical versus combat arms and how, what we're actually requiring people to do, what those jobs actually require that person or individual to do while in service. Because what I see this doing is each career will grow increasingly, not individualized, but specific. If we're looking to retain the skill set moving forward, whereas now it's very broad, interchangeable cogs in a system kind of thing. Whereas I think moving forward, specialization will be, or it has and will continue to become more important, specifically for technology. I mean, and you look forward, you're talking about things like AI, robotics, unmanned systems, and the growth of that. So anybody from either the people repairing and maintaining those systems to actually using them, and the skill sets and the trainings that are going to go into that are probably increase in the time and money, and as well as the ability for the service to retain those service members based off of their technical expertise. So looking at the kind of the tail and the usable time. So the training times are probably going to increase, which include time and budgetary resource. And then so what the military, I think, would like to do is not only retain those people for longer periods of time, but retain them for longer periods of time in order to grow their expertise, to create military readiness, to leverage those technologies successfully.
And you mentioned the future a bit earlier, but I mean, what happens if these things don't change, if kind of requirements strategy and recruitment strategy doesn't change? I mean, what does the military look like in 10 years, in 20 years?
I guess looking back, right? History is the best predictor possibly of the future. So budgets and personnel levels have continued to decline. So if we forecast that out and we say, hey, the personnel and strengths are going to continue to decline and budgetary resources are going to continue to decline, that'll put a greater emphasis on the people that remain in uniform. And then that'll also put a greater emphasis, I think, on the military's retaining those people, because it's going to be harder, I think, to find those people if everything continues to decline. So I think if we assume that is, you know, the glide path of, you know, both those levels, both personnel and budgetary resources are going to continue to decline, along with, I guess, the assumption that the use of those forces will either maintain the operational posture that it currently has or increase, which is kind of common throughout, you know, the decades of study I've looked at, then you have this really, you have a declining force, again, meeting these increasing or steady operational requirements. And then again, you go through the cycle again of personnel when you start talking about retention and people facing burnout. And then you start, it's the wicked problem set of, okay, so now you can't retain enough people. And now it goes back to the recruiting issue. So I think really when it all stems back to allowing those standards or kind of getting the entrance requirements or standards correct, you provide a better baseline with the current assumptions, I guess, that the military could operate in, assuming they're going to remain the same, I think further emphasizes just the importance of the argument that was presented to senior leaders and trying to address the issue now, not a decade in the future.
And do you think this is going to change? I mean, do senior leaders seem receptive to this argument?
I mean, a lot of people, if you would have told me like a decade ago, senior leaders were listening, I would, you know, probably just like every skeptical young person in uniform, be like, ah, oh, no, they don't care. They're just, but I really do. Like, I mean that, you know, you have the DOD hired their first chief talent management officer. So you have, you know, Mr. Britt Parmeter up there, who I've heard speak and gotten to talk to a few times at some of the conferences surrounding the AVF. You have senior leaders really engaged in dialogues. You have think tanks around DC trying to crack the problem set. You have military leaders that are at the conferences listening to scholars and think tanks and, you know, trying to get answers. And you have a lot of these people all in multiple rooms over the course of, you know, since the all-volunteer force turned 50. So since 2023, you have a lot of really important people that I think are not only receptive, but you see improvements starting to happen. And I think really, you know, young service members have the ear of a lot of senior leaders, which I think is encouraging because it really, I think, emphasizes the importance of the issue. And I think it really emphasizes senior leaders, both civilian and uniform, coming to junior people like, hey, you know, we need your help. Like, this is a, not necessarily finger pointing, but like, this is a you problem. Like, your generation and beyond before you is who we're trying to recruit. So like, we need your help in solving this problem, and to really listen intently and to demonstrate, like, that's a lot of humility coming from people that have spent, you know, 3-4 decades in uniform, if not more, point at some of the most junior people like, hey, we really need your help solving this. And I really do think, you know, the ears of senior leaders are open. I think that's super encouraging for the problem that's at hand.
All right. Well, unfortunately, that is our time. But thank you for coming on The Insider and talking this through with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Aaron.